before we get into Lost Sounds and that book, what piqued your interest in terms of early recordings prior to, say, 1920? Has this always been a kind of a hobby of yours?
Yes, it has, and it goes back a way. It's a long and winding road. But to put it briefly, in the 1980s, I was always very interested in the early history of the recording industry, and I kept running across the name of one particular artist about whom there seemed to be many conflicting and interesting stories, but nobody really knew the truth about him. His name was George W. Johnson, and he was alleged to be the first successful black recording artist. But again, the stories about him are all over the map, one of the more prominent being that he was hung for throwing his wife out the window and died a terrible death. I decided it might be interesting to see what I could find out about him, perhaps write an article about him. And as I dug into his life, which was very difficult to find out about, I kept running into other artists of that period who were African-American as well. And that seemed to run contrary to the prevailing notions that there really were very few, if any, blacks who recorded prior to the boom in jazz and blues in the 1920s. Most of the books seem to assume that Bessie Smith stood in front of a recording horn in 1920, and that was the birth of African-American music. But I kept finding all these other people, so I thought, well, maybe I'll see what I can find out about them, too, and the book kind of grew from there.
I understand that Richard and Megan had known you for a while, but who first raised the possibility of them following up the book with the CD release?
The book came out eventually in 2004 after 15 years of research, and it was quite well received, especially in the academic community. It won several awards, and I had known Richard for a number of years. He began his label in the 90s, I believe, and knew that he specialized in early recordings and also did write by them. His packaging, his transfers and reproductions of these early recordings were top rate in a field that very little was being done in. So he suggested, I believe, to me that would I be interested in working on a CD to accompany the book or to make some of the recordings that I talked about in the book actually available to listeners today. And I'd been talking with a couple of other labels about that, too, and even the publisher of the book had suggested that I might put out a CD with the book. However, that's a big operation in itself, and I didn't have the time to do that at the same time I was writing the book. So when Richard came along, and knowing how good his credentials were, I agreed immediately.
Were there particular tracks? How about, like, the songs you researched in, not having seen the whole book, compared to what is in this this compilation? Were there things that had to be sought out, or was there a very natural connection between the two?
There is a natural connection. There wasn't in 1989 when I started down this road, but over the course of compiling and publishing the book, I had collected a very large collection of these recordings, and some of them took years and years and years to track down. I had examples of almost all of the artists who recorded and who were discussed in the book. Basically, they get one chapter each in the book. So I already had a large number of recordings to choose from. There were a few that eluded us and eluded me, but many I had to choose from. So I would say that I probably had a couple of hundred records to choose from, and then the goal became which ones would be most representative of the artist. We wanted to represent all of the artists in Lost Sounds, if possible, and what would be the best copies, and how could we put the list together in a way that would make the CD sound varied, too. Of course, eventually it became two CDs. And one thing I would say about the CD, by the way, kind of the model in the back of my head was a double LP that came out in the early 1960s when RCA Victor Records at that time celebrated its 60th anniversary, and they put out 60 years of music America loves best. And what struck me about, I was a kid at the time, but what struck me about that LP, that double LP, was that it was such an enormous variety of music. Usually LPs and CDs are one artist or one type of music, and if you like that, that's fine. But that was something that introduced me to kinds of music that I never would have heard otherwise. There was Glenn Miller next to opera, next to rock and roll, next to blues. It was country music, all kind of jumbled together, like American music is. So with this CD, I wanted to represent that kind of diversity and that kind of variety and that kind of surprise with every track that I had experienced, 40 years earlier when I had first heard that LP. So the CD has everything from spirituals to solo artists to banjo players to early jazz kinds of things and very rhythmic stuff to concert music to spoken word of poetry being read. So it shows the whole breadth of music and art that was being created by blacks at that time, which I thought was interesting, and I hoped other people would find interesting too.
Well, talk about winning a Grammy too. This was submitted, and how did you feel about chances back when?
Frankly, I thought it had. I was amazed that it was and proud that it was nominated. I didn't think it had a chance, because the Grammys, if you look back at the awards that they've given over the past, 20 years or so that they've given awards for historical reissues, have invariably been either for well-known jazz artists or very famous people of the 30s or 40s. They've never recognized something this early. So I was proud to be nominated, certainly, in two categories, for the reissue and for Best Liner Notes. And we all decided to go out because it was a chance to attend the Grammys, something we'll probably never have another chance to do. But in terms of winning, I was amazed.
Now, what relationship does this have with your day job with Lifetime, or does it?
Virtually none. Okay. although I will tell you, I write books about the television industry too. I'm a historian in that field. And I work in cable television, which is kind of the new wave of television since the 80s at least, as opposed to the TV that began in the 50s, the over-the-air television. And the business of the recording industry in the 1890s and early 1900s, when it was kind of an outsider industry, a new technology people didn't really understand, had to really be sold to the public, did not have big auspices behind it, is not unlike the new forms of television that have arisen over the last 20 years that kind of countered the establishment and the huge companies that dominated the field in television in the 50s and 60s. So the entrepreneurs who run it, cable television has been a door for women and minorities to rise in the television business, and they were pretty much shut out in the 50s and 60s in the broadcast business, which was very male and very establishment. And likewise, the record industry in the early days was a door in for outsiders, which in that day meant minorities. And whereas there wouldn't be a chance that a black person, no matter how talented they were, could get into finance or the established businesses of the day. Here was a business where they could get in on somebody else's terms, to be sure, but they could be heard. And once they showed their ability to actually sell records and make money for people, they gradually got more clout and power in the business. And toward the end of this period, several of the records on the CD represent the first black-owned record label, which came about in 1919, which, again, was unknown at the time I started my research. Not only the first black record label, but a label that specialized in kinds of music that people thought that blacks would never record, concert music and classical music, art music. So from the beginning of this period, when it was strictly, sing the songs we tell you to sing, to the end of the period when blacks were actually running their own labels and recording the way they wanted to, was quite a transition.
Yeah, this was more just due to the age, to that time. It was not because someone else was pushing the buttons. There were just a lot of recordings that, like recordings by other artists that just had to be discovered.
Yes, yes. And We've largely ignored this period. It was acoustically recorded, which means that the artist had to record into a big horn, and there was no electricity, no amplification, no chance to do retakes or anything like that. It was the sound of their voice was focused on a little needle that etched into a wax master. So it was a much more difficult recording process then, and those records don't sound as full as records made in later years, so they don't tend to be reissued as much. It's kind of like silent movies or black and white films or something like that. And yet, this period, this 1890 to 1920, was one of the most creative periods in American history in terms of culture and art. This is the heart of a period when African American sensibilities were suddenly being infused into American culture, and of course they've had enormous impact on American culture since then. But this is the period when it started, because before this it was a world of a very white world, and about the only thing that representation of African Americans was a minstrel show, which was a parody, of course. And here's the period where the Fisk singers started to be heard, when the voices of people like Booker T. Washington started to be heard, when black poets like Dunbar started to be heard, when jazz, ragtime, and then jazz, black music started to be heard. So it's right in that period when our culture started to change and reflect our African Americans. And here's the recorded evidence of that, which just hasn't been heard before.
Who stands out for you? And if you had time to play one or two for someone.
Well, the early recordings by James Reese Europe, are fascinating recordings. He was the first. He had the first African American orchestra to record, band really, in 1913. And the recordings he made are so incredibly uninhibited. There's the band people, like, they're rhythmic and they're fast-paced, and the band members are like shouting, encouraging each other on during it. And during the Victorian era, that was just absolutely unheard of. Nobody did that. Everything was by the script and was very stilted and so forth. So just the energy and the vivacity that comes out of those recordings, which is represented on the CD by Down Home Rag, which is also written by a black composer, Albus Wetman. It's so fascinating to do this, both the book and the CD, because it got me deeply involved in fields that I'd not known a lot about before. I'm mostly interested in pop music, but here's the classical artists. One of the most inspiring stories in the book, and the music's on the CD, is Roland Hayes, I think, who wanted to be and was very talented as a classical tenor. But that was a field that was absolutely closed to blacks, and he could get no manager to take him on. He could get no concert hall to let him sing. He couldn't get work, basically, because that wasn't allowed for blacks then. And the record companies were rather explicit in saying, you know, we don't want you, and nor do our buyers. So he actually raised money on his own to rent a concert hall, and it turned out that the concert was a great success. And then from that he went on to make his own records, which he paid for and his friends distributed. And one of those records is on here. It's Esti La Juba from Pagliacci, which you do not expect in 1919 or 1918 to hear a black singer singing. But it shows that he could hold his own with the best, with the Carusos of the day. So there's that type of music that I was not aware of, the Harry T. Burleigh recording, which comes right after that. Harry T. Burleigh was an enormously influential concert musician. in the early 1900s. He was a student of Dvorak when Dvorak was in this country writing the New World Symphony, and very famously, he is the one who informed Dvorak about American spirituals, and of course Dvorak then wrote those themes into his most famous symphony, The New World, and admonished American, serious American musicians in 1895 or 4, I think it was, that look to the black Americans in your midst. This is where the future of American music is, which was like an incredible statement to make in those days. And he was right. And Burley is the one that led him to that music. Burley had an enormously successful concert career at the time. Several books have been written about Burley. They all say we'll never hear his voice because he never recorded. Well, he did record, and I found the record. And here it is. He's singing his own arrangement of Go Down, Moses.
But if the Lord called Moses, said, let my people